Hello, this is Brian Auten of Apologetics 315. Today's interview is with biologist and apologist Jonathan McClatchy. The interview is conducted today by Carson Whitenauer. And now here's Carson to introduce our guest.
Hello, I'm Carson Whitenauer, and today's interview is with Jonathan McClatchy, who is an apologist and a proponent of intelligent design. Jonathan has earned an honors degree in forensic biology at the University of Strathclyde and a master's degree in evolutionary biology at the University of Glasgow. Jonathan blogs at evolutionnews.org and uncommondescent.com, where he has developed a reputation for detailed studies in the biological systems related to intelligent design. Jonathan, it is a pleasure to be talking with you today.
Thank you for having me on the program today.
Well, Jonathan, to begin our interview, can you give us some background about your current work and your journey to where you are today?
Sure. Well, I was raised in a Christian home. I became a Christian in 1996, at the age of about seven. I became very interested in apologetics and theology and science as I began my science degree back in 2007. Particularly as I progressed in my science degree, I became very aware of the unambiguous and clear evidence of design in biology. I was often baffled at how anyone could go through a four-year college program in biology and come out an atheist the other end. There was just so much clear evidence of information processing and retrieval systems and, the regulatory control of the cell cycle, these rotary motors and sliding clamps that are the bread and butter of biological systems. These are very difficult to explain without intelligent agency. And in our cause and effect experience of the nature of the world, we know that these types of effects routinely trace their origin back to an intelligent source. And so I became very interested in this question of biological origins. And so I've been very active on the blogosphere and in discussions with people and really trying to get this to encourage people to explore this topic.
Well, we're going to get into all of those details. That's really fascinating the way you would say, how can you go through a four-year degree in biology and come out an atheist? Because, of course, I think that's a fairly common perception of what a degree in science would do. And it's encouraging to see that you've seen much more of a connection between rigorous intellectual study in the sciences and your faith in God. Can you say more about the nature of your relationship with God and how you came to faith and how your faith in particular has been strengthened by worshiping God with your mind and investigating the sciences?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, I became a Christian in 1996, and I became interested in apologetics somewhat later, about a decade later, as I entered the university level. And I became very interested in why I believe Christianity to be true, or is it true? There are people of other worldviews that hold very different positions. I've interacted with many people of other worldview persuasions, such as Muslims and Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses, and I became very interested in why Christianity in particular is true. If you speak to people of other worldview persuasions, it's often the answer you will get if you ask them for rational justification of their belief system is, well, I have this spiritual experience, or I just have this feeling that it's true, particularly with Mormons, that will tell you that they prayed and received a burning in their bosom. I'm interested in objective facts that are publicly accessible. And I think the evidence for Christianity is very compelling, particularly the evidence for the resurrection and the evidence from the messianic types and foreshadows, the way that the cross is a culmination of all of Scripture, the evidence for the divine self-understanding of Jesus, and the general reliability of the New Testament. And when you take it as a cumulative argument, I've always found that pretty compelling. I find the evidence for the existence of God to be very overwhelming, even more compelling than the evidence for Christianity in particular, particularly the biological evidence, which is my own area of specialization, but also evidence from physics, such as the Kalam cosmological argument, the fine-tuning argument that the universe not only began to exist at one defined point in the non-infinite past, but also began to it also came into being with immense precision and fine tuning and optimization, and that to me, when taken as a cumulative argument, strongly suggests design. And so that's really how I got into this, and I've been involved in dialoguing with people on the internet and Facebook and in person, and trying to find out why they believe what they believe and give alternative points of view.
I'm really encouraged, and I hope our listeners get that as a takeaway, that you haven't lived out your Christian beliefs in a non-rational bubble of faith and authority and dogma, but in dialogue with people from many different worldviews, and obviously with a wide range of intellectual investigation, from theistic arguments to specifically Christian arguments. And I think that's commendable and something we ought to dedicate ourselves to. Now, within that general framework of as an apologist, it's clear that your specialty is intelligent design. And I'm wondering if today we can try and get an intelligent design 101 tutorial for our listeners. And to get us started, how would you define, after all of your research, intelligent design?
So intelligent design is a study of patterns in nature which are best explained as the product not of undirected material processes of chance and necessity, but rather of an intelligent causal agent. So intelligent design is already part of the natural sciences. If you look at forensic science, for example, which is what my first degree was in, you know, the whole discipline thrives on being able to discern, you know, did someone die of natural causes or were they murdered? You know, that's a design inference. And, you know, there's design inferences when you investigate arsons, for example, or fraudulent claims. There is design inferences made in archaeology. You know, the SETI program all the time is looking for extraterrestrial intelligence and, you know, looking for radio waves that may be sent to try to communicate us from an extraterrestrial civilization. You know, many of your listeners may have seen the movie Contact, where SETI researchers, in this fictional narrative, you know, they receive signals from outer space that were the first, 20 prime numbers, which, you know, is very difficult to explain as a product of simply random noise, and in fact is better explained by an intelligent cause. And so intelligent design is already part of our mode of reasoning, and we reason, we infer to intelligence as part of our daily routine lives. And the theory of intelligent design as applied to biology is taking those methods of design detection, this design inference, and applying it to what we find in biological systems, such as bacterial flagella, which is a rotary motor engine which propels many motile bacteria through liquid. Looking at, you know, the DNA and the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA, and how they serve as mediums for information, how DNA is taken and is transcribed into an intermediary molecule called messenger RNA, and that's subsequently translated into proteins. That information processing and retrieval mechanism, you know, is best explained by an intelligent cause, because we know when we look at information in every other realm of experience, whether it be a newspaper headline or whether it be a computer programming script or whether it be the text and pages of a book, whenever we trace the source of that information, it routinely comes back to an intelligent cause. And so that's basically the essence of the design hypothesis.
I think it's helpful that you're explaining this, the analogy of a design inference in a lot of fields that people are familiar with, and that therefore this is not anything unusual or out of the ordinary or illegitimate when we move to the biological sciences. Now, in explaining what intelligent design was, you gave us some helpful examples, that of the information in DNA and of some functionality in the bacteria's flagellum. And I'm wondering, can you explicate for us what are the top reasons why you think intelligent design is the best scientific theory for explaining the diversity of life we see on this Earth?
Right. So the inference that intelligent design is predicated upon, and you know, traces its origin back to a methodology pioneered by the great 19th century geologist Charles Lyell, who wrote a very famous book in the history of science called Principles of Geology, being the attempt to understand changes in the Earth's surface with reference to causes now in operation. And so this, Charles Lyell argued in this book that if one wants to infer a cause for an event in the remote past, one should let one's one's present cause and effect experience guide their search for that best explanation. And so when it comes to, you know, explaining, for example, the presence of volcanic ash, we favor the volcanic eruption hypothesis over the earthquake hypothesis, because in our uniform repeated experience, or cause and effect experience, the only known source of volcanic ash is a volcanic eruption, not an earthquake. And so we reason back, we extrapolate back from our present experience into the past. And when we're talking about information, you know, we have plenty of information in our modern era. We look at information and we know that every time information arises, it traces its origin back to an intelligent source. Just like as we do in other scientific disciplines, we are inferring to the best explanation for multiple competing hypotheses, and we know that intelligence is known to produce large volumes of complex and functionally specific information, whereas other causes like natural selection, random genetic mutation, genetic drift, are shown to be impotent in producing that information. And so that would be the design inference and why I think is the best explanation.
So can you say more about the design filter and how that works out? How do you define that? How do you apply it in say one case?
Right. So basically there are two criteria necessary to establish a design inference. One is complexity. So something must be exceedingly complex, and the complexity should exhaust the probabilistic resources at one's disposal. So when we're talking about the origin of life and looking at the world of the cell, is the complexity of the cell so substantial that it actually exhausts the probabilistic resources available since, say, the beginning of the universe would be a very generous estimate. So the second criterion that it must meet is it must be functionally specific. In other words, it must conform to an independently given specified pattern. So for example, in a paragraph of text. Now, any given sequence of the letters in that paragraph of text are equally improbable. There's no, if you assume that all the characters are available for every digit, all the potential sequences are equally improbable, and yet there's only a small subset within that, within that combinatorial sequence space, if you will. There's only a small subset of sequences of alphabetic characters would actually convey some sort of meaning, and that would be what we would call specified. So if it's complex and it's specified, we infer that it, in fact, has an intelligent cause.
Right. So how is this different from the mainstream theory of evolution? Can you define the mainstream theory for us and then explain some of the conceptual differences between that and intelligent design?
So the mainstream neo-Darwinian theory would maintain that life is the product of an entirely unguided process involving various natural processes, including natural selection, random genetic mutation, genetic drift, symbiogenesis, and other processes which have no mind involved. Whereas intelligent design would argue to the contrary, that in fact intelligence is indispensable in accounting for the origins of life. So it would argue, for example, that the specified complexity found in amino acid residues that make up proteins. Amino acids are subunits of proteins, and they're arranged, and the sequential arrangement of the amino acids determines how a protein will collapse into a functional structure, a stable and functional structure, and how that will then move out into the cell and perform some biochemical role.
So now, do you think that holding to intelligent design involves a wholesale rejection of the neo-Darwinian synthesis of evolution, or do you see them as being integrated together in some fashion?
I see them as, intelligent design doesn't necessarily reject the proposition of universal common ancestry. That's not what it's challenging. So if by evolution you simply mean universal common ancestry, then intelligent design and evolution are perfectly compatible. If, however, you mean by evolution this whole notion that life is the product of a purely chance necessity process, then I would say they are, in fact, not compatible, because intelligent design maintains that life is the product of intelligence. There's different definitions of evolution. There's the proposition that life simply changes over time, the changes in allele frequency that occur in a population over time. Or there's the proposition that all of life share common ancestors, and the further you trace back our history, the more all of life comes back to common ancestors until eventually you come to a single universal common ancestor, which was the progenitor of all future life. Or there's the proposition that life is the product of unguided, blind, chance necessity processes involving processes like natural selection, genetic drift, random genetic mutation, and that's that view that life is the exclusive product of chance necessity is incompatible with ID, and that's in fact what ID is challenging. Now, in fact, many individual ID proponents will take views on common ancestry, and many of us disagree with common ancestry, but that's not part of what ID is challenging.
I see. It's helpful to have that kind of nuance that the intelligent design movement and mainstream evolutionary theory are interacting on a range of issues, and we've got to be clear about exactly what is being challenged in terms of these scientific theories. Now, the ID movement, as I'm sure you're aware, is quite a controversial hypothesis. And why do you think that is? What's at stake in this disagreement between evolutionary proponents and the intelligent design movement?
Well, I think, you know, evolutionary theory is unique among many scientific disciplines because it's so closely wedded to the materialistic worldview. And you know, people, understandably, when their worldview is challenged, react sometimes in very emotional and sometimes irrational ways. And I think this is one explanation for much of the hostility within the academic community towards intelligent design proponents. Intelligent design, you know, it isn't based on, you know, metaphysical premises. It's not based on religious particular interpretations of religious scripture, and it's not based on a particular worldview like Christianity or anything like that. But intelligent design may have larger metaphysical religious worldview implications, and a lot of people don't like the potential metaphysical implications of intelligent design. But one has to bear in mind that evolutionary theory also has larger metaphysical implications. And if life is the product of a chance, necessity, unguided process, then is that really compatible with a traditional understanding of God's providence in nature? You know, is he, can God direct an unguided process that view being logically incoherent? And so that seems to me to be very problematic.
So there's no way to avoid metaphysics in our
That's correct.
Approach to science.
That's correct.
Well, now, some of the critics of intelligent design have raised some challenging questions to the view you've just presented, and understandably they would say, no, this isn't about my worldview. This isn't an emotional issue for me. I'm not being irrational. Rather, I have a principled and reasoned objection to the intelligent design movement. And one of the objections they would raise is that it's really not possible to detect intelligent design through scientific study, and that's an unwarranted going beyond the evidence. How would you respond to that challenge?
Well, my response would be that we already do detect intelligent design in our everyday lives, in our routine experience. You know, we read newspaper headlines and we immediately infer that these were in fact designed. You know, Richard Dawkins, when he wrote The God Delusion, you know, when we read his book, we immediately infer that that book arose by some sort of intelligent agency. So, you know, we look at, you know, Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, you know, we see presidents' faces carved into the rock there, and we immediately infer that someone spent a lot of time working on that, and some intelligent agency produced that. You know, we've got this method of pattern recognition. We know that specified complexity routinely originates from an intelligent source, and we don't presently know of any cause that produces specified complexity apart from intelligence. So, intelligent design is based on the standard principles of scientific methodology. This inference to the best explanation for multiple competing hypotheses, you know, is held tentatively. So it's possible that in the future some explanation of specified complexity could come along and displace intelligent design. But as things stand at present, it is currently the most causally efficacious or the most causally adequate or the best explanation for what we see.
Right. Well, some might say, okay, we can detect intelligent design when we look at Mount Rushmore or a newspaper, but how would we detect intelligent design in the emergence of more developed life forms? How do we specify, okay, here's the moment when the intelligent designer acted and took the species from this developmental form to that developmental form? How do we get to a specificity of identifying the active work of some kind of intelligent designer?
So in the case of the origin of life, for example, we can look at cases of specified complexity, such as the information necessary to construct the polypeptide chains that constitute proteins, or looking at, you know, the hereditary molecules of DNA and RNA. Probably RNA was the first genetic material, and we can infer that, you know, a specified complexity is required to explain these. I mean, the prevalence of functional, stable protein folds within sequence space, or the vast array of combinatorial possibilities of arranging amino acids, is astronomically small. And this, to me, is a tremendous challenge to neo-Darwinism, and yet it conveys information. It conveys specified complexity, and that is the criterion by which we detect intelligent design.
So
when we're looking at, you know, the Cambrian explosion is another case. So it's 530 million years ago, the most of the major animal body plans called the phyla appear very abruptly within a very narrow geological window of time, so 5 to 10 million years, and they require lots of cases of morphological innovation, anatomical novelty, and that's another case where intelligence must play an indispensable role in accounting for it. The origins of compound eyes and trilobites, for example, the origins of body plants, the origins of these proteins and genetic material and regulatory circuits that are required to explain development in animals. All of these arise within a very narrow window of time without clear predecessors in the Precambrian strata.
Does the intelligent design hypothesis lead us to understand a fairly active intelligent designer of some kind who is quite regularly intervening in the development of life, and here, new body form, and here, new development of proteins, and here, a better eye. And so on a fairly regular basis, there's some kind of intelligent intervention throughout the animal species and bacteria and so on, to develop more complex life?
Well, one could take that position, but there are a number of positions that one could take on this, a number of ways of looking at this question. So one hypothesis, for example, is that the world was set up and the world has some sort of intrinsic teleology or intrinsic intelligence built into it. Perhaps, this is even compatible with a theistic understanding of the universe, where God sets up the world in such a way that it will give rise to these structures and these systems and this anatomical complexity. So that's one way of looking at it. Or you could take, as you just described, the interventionalist view. I'm fairly agnostic on that question. I don't think the evidence is entirely unambiguous one way or the other on that question.
Now, another criticism that's been raised of intelligent design is that it's only a God of the gaps theory. And do you think there are cases where the intelligent design framework has led or been a God of the gaps approach? And how do we avoid that so that we are making a distinction between intelligent design approaches and God of the gaps thinking?
So the God of the gaps argument would be to say that since I can't explain phenomenon X, therefore I am plugging God to explain it, and God becomes a placeholder for what we don't know and what we can't explain yet. Whereas intelligent design isn't like that at all. It doesn't work that way. Intelligent design argues that there are certain phenomena which are best explained by intelligent causes, and so when we see information in all of our experience, we know that it traces its origin back to an intelligent source, and therefore we can infer intelligent design as the currently best explanation for what we find in biology. If intelligent design makes any positive arguments at all, it's not by definition a God of the gaps argument, and therefore whatever else may be wrong with it is definitely not wrong because it's a God of the gaps argument. People that I've spoken with who are critics of intelligent design have conceded that much, that whatever else may be wrong with it is not a God of the gaps argument. So it's based not on what we don't know, but what we do know about the complexity of biological systems, what's needed to explain our innovation, and what in all of our uniform repeated experience of cause and effect is known to produce information, and that one cause is intelligence, and therefore I would argue that intelligent design is not a God of the gaps argument.
So, to make sure I understand you correctly, a God of the gaps approach is an argument from ignorance, which is a logical fallacy. You're saying, I don't know how to do this, and the convenient answer is to say, the designer did it. But what you're saying is intelligent design has a definition for detecting design and saying, okay, if we have, specified complexity and these other features, then it's right to infer an intelligent actor. And when we look at biological systems, we find that definition is met, and that's why we're making this inference from the biological systems to the activity of an intelligent designer. And that's a positive case.
That's right. And in fact, there is a converse fallacy, which is committed on the materialist side of this discussion, where they will say, well, we can't explain it yet, and so we'll just plug in, you know, we'll come up with a materialistic explanation at some point in the future. And this is like what you might call a materialism of the gaps fallacy. In fact, there's a very similar fallacy involved in one of the major arguments for Darwinism, which is offered, for example, by Francis Collins in his book, The Language of God. This whole notion of junk DNA, you know, it's the case that only 1.5% of our DNA, in fact, codes for proteins, and the rest of our DNA is non-coding DNA, doesn't code for proteins. And one interpretation of this is that much of the rest of it, with rare exception, is in fact non-functional. It doesn't have any function, and this is the, and this is explained as a result of these blind, undirected, purposeless processes, and this is just the this is just the accumulation of garbage in our genome that's resulted from this blind, undirected, unintelligent process. Whereas this argument has come under fire in recent years with this onslaught of evidence that in fact the non-coding regions are in fact have pervasive function. And so the argument for Darwinism that Francis Collins and many others have articulated in fact shrinks with each new advance in scientific understanding. And so I would describe that as closer to a God of the Gaps fallacy than it would intelligent design.
So I think that's a broader principle here for our listeners, is that logical fallacies are a human phenomenon and not necessarily a religious phenomenon or an a-religious phenomenon, but that every community is suspect to these logical fallacies, and we have to exercise due diligence to treat our own position with skepticism and challenge it to see if we are thinking with rigor. Now, to challenge the intelligent design theory, how could we falsify it? What evidence would make you go, you know what, the biological systems are not intelligently designed? How would, is that a possibility? How would that come about?
Sure, intelligent design could be falsified. So it's based on two premises. The design inference is based on two premises. There's premise one, biological systems are chock full of specified complexity. And premise two, intelligence is the best explanation for specified complexity. So if you could show that either of those two premises is false, then intelligent design as an inference would be falsified. So you could show, for example, that there are other causes which produce specified complexity, or that life doesn't in fact contain specified complexity. Say you were to demonstrate that in fact the prevalence of stable and functional protein folds within sequence space is in fact quite amenable to a step-by-step gradualistic Darwinian pathway. It wouldn't in fact exhibit specified complexity. Then, you know, that would refute the design hypothesis. So I think there are ways to falsify ID.
And that, I think, creates a lively debate about the premises, but at least they're clear and at least they're open for discussion.
Mm-hmm.
So what predictions has intelligent design generated? How have these predictions been confirmed? What kind of scientific support do you think the movement enjoys?
So one prediction intelligent design makes is that because when intelligent designers, when intelligent agents act, they produce things which are functional in some way, they convey meaning. And so when we look at, you know, the non-coding regions of our DNA, we, even though it wasn't known a decade ago what much of this was doing, we were able to predict, in fact, that much of it would turn out to have function. And although we don't know what the majority, or we don't know what the majority of our DNA is doing at present, the trend has been for the preponderance of our DNA to turn out, in fact, to have function. So that would be one prediction which I would say is confirmed. I'd say that the converse of that, that much of our DNA would not be functional, is in fact a prediction which flows very readily from a Darwinian view of the origins and development of life. I'd say another prediction is that, you know, when we look at biological systems, we should find specified complexity, because that's what intelligent design would predict. And I think, you know, Doug Axe's research, for example, in 2004 in the Journal of Molecular Biology, which estimated the prevalence of amino acid sequences adopting stable and functional folds. He looked at a particular enzyme called beta-lactamase, which is involved in conferring antibiotic resistance to certain bacteria, and that's another case of a confirmed prediction. So I'd say that there are many predictions that ID makes. Another one would be that, you know, as time progresses, we'll find more and more factors that are finely tuned in our universe, more and more constants and conditions that need to be finely tuned, both for the universe's existence as a whole and for the evolution or origins of advanced intelligent life on Earth. So, I mean, these are three predictions, but ID makes many more.
And would you say that, you know, if someone's doing biological sciences and they go into the lab looking for specified complexity, do you think that would accelerate their research program and actually lead to better and stronger scientific results?
Yeah, I think it could produce more results. I think intelligent design has much heuristic value in that regard. In fact, intelligent design, you know, has much promising potential. And I think if it becomes, you know, we, for example, in the case of non-coding DNA, you know, it could accelerate, and taking the intelligent design standpoint, could accelerate the process by which we elucidate functions for this DNA, because we expect it to turn out to have function. And so using intelligent design as a theory, an approach to scientific research, I think could in fact hold much heuristic value.
That's very interesting. So now we've covered a lot of different issues, both arguments for intelligent design and looked provisionally at some of the challenges to it. What would you say to people who are listening to this program who are on the fence and they're really not sure who to believe or who to trust or how to weigh the evidence? What would be your words to them as they think about the theory of intelligent design?
Well, I would say to read as much of the literature on both sides of this issue. There's a phenomenal new book that has just been published just yesterday, in fact, by Dr. Stephen Meyer, who's a Cambridge-trained philosopher of science. This new book is called Darwin's Doubt, and it explores many of the challenges to the neo-Darwinian synthesis and also presents a positive argument for intelligent design. This book focuses on the Cambrian explosion, but uses this as a springboard to discuss other issues, which are, for example, how to explain the origins of body plans, or how to explain the origins of protein folds, or how to explain, you know, morphological innovation, development of gene networks. So I'd say to read that. I'd also say to read Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design, which is a great book which focuses on the origins of life on Earth and argues that intelligent design is the best explanation. It doesn't just focus on the negative arguments, the arguments against materialistic explanations. I'd also say to read books on the other side of this controversy, some books which cover the evidence for evolution, Jerry Coyne's book, Why Evolution is True, for example, or you could read Richard Dawkins' book, The Greatest Show on Earth, or there's a classical book by Ernst Mayr called What Evolution Is, which focuses on the basic principles of evolution. And there's many, many more resources that you could find on the internet. There is many listed at the Discovery Institute website. There's the blog evolutionnews.org, where you can follow the latest updates. There's on commondescent.com. And I just encourage readers to continue to read and discuss these issues.
I think that's really helpful advice, and I'm glad you mentioned resources on both sides. And as people engage with that, they can really consider the evidence as impartially and objectively as possible. And I hope they'll engage with Dr. Meyer's arguments. I found him to be a very lucid and clear writer, and the way he expresses very difficult scientific concepts to be very approachable and accessible to the average reader.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jonathan, I'd like to ask, what have you learned from doing apologetics online? You write a lot of blog posts. They're often very detailed and thorough. What has that process taught you?
It's taught me that, you know, I'm very interested in presenting both sides. I want to be fair to the other side of the discussion, and so I want to state the facts which support not just my own case, but their case as well. So I'm interested in, stating, you know, where the balance of evidence lies, usually in controversies like, usually in scientific controversies and controversies relating to historiography or scholarship. There is evidence on both sides. The evidence isn't all unambiguously on one side of the issue, but there is, in fact, a balance of evidence, and I'm interested in articulating that, and I think that that's been it's been helpful to learn that. I've also been able to learn from many of my critics, particularly on the intelligent design controversy where I spent most of my effort. I always try to understand where they're coming from and understand and see where my arguments need to be adjusted or refined or revised. I've learned always to be civil in discussions with people. I think that's very important and quality of a writer. These things I would say are important.
Now, that's obviously, as someone who does a fair amount of apologetics work online as well, you know, the comments section can be a very heated section of internet websites. What spiritual formation practices or community practices or other habits do you have to approach those conversations in a civil way and in a kind way? How do you maintain that approach in the impersonal nature of internet dialogue?
I always try to be civil myself, and obviously I can't control how other people behave. I think that moderation of comments and in the context of a blog is important. I'd say I just try to maintain myself. I try to be a good example, I hope other people on the other side of this discussion reciprocate that.
That's the best we can hope for. So now, you clearly do a lot of research in the field. What are some of your work and study habits that others could learn from?
Well, I have an iPad in which I have a database that I've constructed of thousands of scientific papers, and they're all categorized in a nested hierarchical fashion, and I think that's very useful for engaging in scholarship, so I can pull up papers very quickly, I can find them easily, I can pull them up in debates and dialogues. So I've always found that very helpful. Also, I have a massive array of about 400 books on my Kindle, which is also on my iPad, so I have access to much literature in various disciplines, including scientific textbooks, and I've always found that very helpful. I also try to write literature reviews for my own edification, so I can keep up with the literature better, try to dialogue with people who are scientists and exchange ideas and get feedback on my own arguments, and these things I find very helpful as I try to stay abreast of the current developments.
I think those are all really important tips. One of the ones that I found most helpful is that writing literature reviews and summarizing information. And when I engage in that process, I really come to own the material at a far deeper level, and that prepares me to be a better service to others. Well, Jonathan, what would be your final words to our listeners today as we close out this interview?
Well, I'd like to say thanks for having me on, and I've enjoyed sharing intelligent design and the principles of it. What I'd say to your listeners is just to keep learning and keep researching and considering both sides, not just the side you currently agree with, and I hope you go where the evidence leads.
I think that's an excellent way to end, and I want to commend that to our listeners as well. And to all of our listeners, please be sure to check out Jonathan's work at uncommondissent.com and evolutionnews.org. Jonathan, this has been a very informative and encouraging interview. Thank you so much for your time and your insightful perspective.
Thanks.
This has been an interview with Jonathan McClatchy, conducted by Carson Whitenauer. Find more of Jonathan's articles at evolutionnews.org and uncommondissent.com. If you've enjoyed the interview, please share it with a friend via Facebook or Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/apologetics315 and on Twitter at twitter.com/apologetics315. Please help us get the word out about good apologetics resources. And I want to thank those who've been supporting Apologetics 315 through their financial gifts, and also for those who use our Amazon affiliate links located at the right-hand side of apologetics315.com. When you do your normal shopping from Amazon, using those links allows a small portion of your purchase to support what we're doing, and it only costs you a click. Those links can also be bookmarked for ease of use whenever you shop online. We continue to transcribe these interviews with the help of volunteer transcribers and donations. So if you'd like to help with more, just email me at interviews@apologetics315.com. We are also still interested in developing an iPhone or Android app for Apologetics 315. However, we're looking for developers or funders for this project. So if you're interested in seeing this project take off, you can contact me at brian@apologetics315.com. If you have suggestions for the interviews, you can also email me at interviews@apologetics315.com. This is Brian Auten, and thanks again for listening.